Well, hi, I'm Matt, one of the Maybridge staff, and as I speak to you, we are back in heavier lockdown as the pandemic continues. It's pretty miserable. We actually had COVID come to the Walmsley household over Christmas. Would have preferred Santa, but we got COVID. But glad to say for us, it wasn't too bad. We're all okay, although, of course, it's not like that for everybody. And with all this going on, once again, it really challenges how we do church. It's been basically almost a year now since we could properly meet, other than a few weeks back in October, which some of us were around for, but maybe even more than that. I think all of this is challenging what we think church is. I haven't met anyone who says, you know what, I prefer church online to meeting in person. It's much better. No, nobody thinks that. This is the best that we can do for now. And thank God we have the technology to even do this, because we wouldn't have had this even maybe 4 or 5 years ago. But of course, church was never just about a service. Maybe at Maybridge at times in the past, we've made it a bit too much about Sundays. We love gathering together. We love worship. We love thinking about the Bible together. We love that it's for people of all ages. And it's great, and it's right that we miss it. But sometimes, I think we drift into making it a bit too much the focus. And if we're not careful, we become more like consumers than contributors. In the last few months, leaders from different areas of church, staff, elders, trustees, have been talking and thinking and praying about how we plot a course for the future of the church, which is quite difficult when we have no idea what we're going to be able to do next month, let alone next year. But actually, in another way, this is a great time to talk about what church is all about, because that doesn't change. Our circumstances can change just like that, but what God calls us to as a church is much more long-term. And we talked it through. We think it's clear if you look back over our history, but also ahead to the future, we want to be a vibrant church community that relentlessly follows Jesus and extravagantly shares the goodness of God. That's our vision. That's what we want to be. But alongside that, we have some values, some particular, you could call it DNA, that explains what we're about, the DNA of the church. Not necessarily new things, but things that need to be expressed in a new way. And those four things that we've come to are these. We do life together, we get stuck in, we're here for you, and we're all about Jesus. We do life together, we get stuck in, we're here for you, and we're all about Jesus. And of course, the last one is the most important. And I really like these because I think they say what we're already about in a really down-to-earth way. But the point is, having this framework gives a bit of a sense of direction and purpose about where we're going. So we're going to talk about one value each week for the next 4 weeks, but with a real eye on how to be practical with it, especially at the moment in these strange circumstances. So today, first week, first key value of Maybridge Community Church is that we do life together. We do life together. We believe that church is more than a Sunday. It's being family to one another for the whole of life. It's authentic relationships, it's good times and bad, it's supporting one another, challenging one another at the same time. Now, I've been a Christian for quite a while now, but I've noticed that the phrase, do life together, has become quite fashionable for Christians to say in recent years. But what does it even mean? And what does it look like here and now when we can't even easily be in the same room together, let alone do life together? The phrase comes from a passage in a New Testament book called 1 Thessalonians, which the early church leader and thinker Paul and his friends Silas and Timothy wrote to a church in the Greek city of Thessalonica, which exists still to this day, actually, as the city of Thessaloniki. And this letter was written with lots of affection. Paul had spent some time in the city, not very much as we'll see, but he really loved the people that he got to know there. He told them about Jesus, a bunch of them became Christians, and that's how the church started. But a few years later, when he writes to them, things have really taken off. And this is what it says early in chapter 1. You became imitators of us and of the Lord, for you welcomed the message in the midst of severe suffering with the joy given by the Holy Spirit. And so you became a model to all the believers in Macedonia and Achaia. The Lord's message rang out from you not only in Macedonia and Achaia, your faith in God has become known everywhere. So this tells a bit of backstory. Paul and his friends have been in the city, and yet when people heard the message about Jesus, they didn't just go, oh yeah, that's true. They were delighted about it. They were joyful. And when that happens, that's when you know someone's got it. The penny's dropped. This Jesus thing is amazing. So this little church begins in Thessaloniki, and the faith and the heartfelt joy they have is so big, so remarkable, it spills over. They become known everywhere. Other Christians, people in Macedonia and Achaia, hear about it too. That's quite a big geographical area. That's like if somebody said, Maybridge Community Church, your faith and joy are so amazing, people know about it all over the UK. You've got a reputation. It would be like that. The church was just known all over. And the point of this was not to say, you've succeeded, Thessalonica, you're the best church, or anything like that. It was to say, this is your story. This is what's happened because you humbly follow Jesus. It's made a difference. It inspires other people. And so what happened in the Thessalonian church was amazing. What was the secret? Were they more intelligent? Were they more well off? Well, no, we know for a fact that there were other churches at the time with more educated people, churches with more money, that did not enjoy this reputation. It was all about their attitude. But the seeds were sown when Paul and his friends had visited the city years earlier. What did they do? What was so significant, so influential, to set the church in this direction? Well, there's actually two passages of the Bible that tell us quite a lot. One is in a book we call Acts, an early history of the church written by Paul's mate Luke, and he records what happened in Thessalonica, and this is the gist of it. This is in Acts 17. And Luke writes, "When Paul and his companions had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a Jewish synagogue. As was his custom, Paul went into the synagogue, and on three Sabbath days he reasoned with them from the scriptures, explaining and proving that the Messiah had to suffer and rise from the dead. 'This Jesus I am proclaiming to you is the Messiah,' he said. Some of the Jews were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, as did a large number of God-fearing Greeks and quite a few prominent women. But other Jews were jealous, so they rounded up some bad characters from the marketplace, formed a mob, and started a riot in the city." Sounds a bit like what happened in Washington this week, unfortunately. Now, we won't spend long on this passage, but what's obvious is that Paul and Silas spoke about their faith a lot. Paul was Jewish. He understands all the Old Testament background that all the other Jewish people believe. So he starts there and he explains how Jesus fulfills all this great stuff. And it was so radical and controversial, it caused a lot of trouble. People got upset. People were not pleased. And the other thing to note for today, though, is that Paul and his friends were not in Thessalonica for very long. It says he was there for three Sabbaths. In other words, three Saturdays. Which means, even if Paul arrived the day after a Sabbath and left the day before a Sabbath, he was definitely in the city for less than 5 weeks. Less than 5 weeks. Let's call it a month. And look at the impact. How is this possible? How does a strange man who believes that Jesus, who most people in the city had never heard of, is the Messiah, the climax of Jewish culture and life, he shows up in a city for a month and has so much impact that the church that grows is internationally famous a few years later. What happened? The second passage of the Bible that tells us what happened is back in 1 Thessalonians, but this time it's chapter 2, where Paul remembers it and he looks at it in a very different way to Luke, totally different emphasis. And he writes this. "You know, brothers and sisters, that our visit to you was not without results. We had previously suffered and been treated outrageously in Philippi, as you know, but with the help of our God, we dared to tell you his gospel in the face of strong opposition. For the appeal we make does not spring from error or impure motives, nor are we trying to trick you. On the contrary, we speak as those approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel. We are not trying to please people, but God, who tests our hearts. You know we never used flattery, nor did we put on a mask to cover up greed. God is our witness. We were not looking for praise from people, not from you or anyone else, even though as apostles of Christ we could have asserted our authority. Instead, we were like young children among you. Just as a nursing mother cares for her children, so we cared for you. Because we loved you so much, we were delighted to share with you not only the gospel of God, but our lives as well. Surely you remember, brothers and sisters, our toil and hardship. We worked night and day in order not to be a burden to anyone while we preached the gospel of God to you. You are witnesses, and so is God, of how holy, righteous and blameless we were among you who believed. For you know that we dealt with each of you as a father deals with his own children. encouraging, comforting, and urging you to live lives worthy of God, who calls you into his kingdom and glory. So this is what Paul and his friends did in Thessalonica. They shared the gospel, they talked about Jesus and what it meant to follow him, and they did that an awful lot. But it wasn't the only thing they did. They didn't just talk. It wasn't a sort of mechanical, right, here's the message, now see you later, we'll go home. No, no, no. You may have noticed that phrase in there. We shared not only the gospel of God, but our lives as well. And that's where we get the idea of doing life together. That's a good summary line of the whole thing. And it's key because Paul is saying, we didn't just show up and do a few Bible studies. Yeah, there was definitely a message, a wonderful message, but also there was an investment in relationships. The rest of the passage basically fleshes out what that looks like. What seeds were sown in this early tiny church community in Thessalonica? I'm going to tell you, and you won't be impressed. It sounds really basic. Paul says, we worked night and day in order not to be a burden on you. We know from elsewhere, Paul had skills as a tent maker. Maybe he did that. Whatever. Paul and Silas had jobs, which meant not only could they pay their way, but they were around people all day where there could be lots of conversation. But people got to see the difference following Jesus made to how they lived. Working during the day, maybe sat around a fire, having some food or something in the evening. But there are character traits written all over this memory. Paul talked about what he and Silas did that was vital, I think, in influencing the Thessalonian church, and which I think needs to be the heart of what it is for us to do life together, here and now, pandemic or otherwise. And I think it boiled down in this passage to basically four things. Firstly, they had integrity. How unspectacular does that sound? They had integrity. And actually, Paul is at pains to talk about this. He says, the appeal we made does not spring from error or impure motives. He says, we speak as those approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel. He says, you are witnesses and so is God of how holy, righteous and blameless we were among you. In other words, there was a remarkable connection between what Paul and Silas told people about Jesus and how they lived. Enough of a connection that Paul can look back and say to people who were there, you know what we were like. This isn't arrogance, it's just honesty. When Paul and Silas did life with people, there had to be a connection between their message and their actions. Everything they said about Jesus would have sounded hollow if at the same time they'd lied and gossiped and manipulated and been defensive and promoted themselves. Because when somebody says, look, Jesus is at the centre of everything, he's amazing, he should be followed with all we have, and then shows in their behaviour that they don't really live that way or believe that, no one's going to listen, are they? And of course it's not that Paul and Silas were perfect, obviously not. Part of being holy, righteous and blameless is actually being honest about your own insufficiencies, your own weaknesses. I have no doubt that when Paul and Silas made mistakes, they just owned it. They just owned it. I actually think they would have been honest about their own shortcomings to a point that we would be uncomfortable with. Why? Because the message was not about how they got things right, but how Jesus did. Which means that living out the good news about Jesus isn't just about being a good person, which is obviously a good thing. It's actually a lot about being honest about where you aren't, about what you're really like. So for us to have integrity is not to go, just to go about things the right way, but to be honest about where we're wrong, because we're not the heroes of the story. So integrity was the unspectacular foundation for everything else that happened here. Second thing, they had depth. Clearly, in the short time Paul was in Thessalonica, he built these really important relationships with people because they spoke with one another in a way that went beyond the surface. Paul was a highly intelligent man. He loved to debate and understand the Bible, and that's part of it. But it's really important. Depth in relationships is not just about intellectual depth. Depth in relationships is about sharing of yourself, knowing others, and being known back. And I suspect many of us have relationships where we see certain people at, you know, a reasonable amount, but there's no depth. Simply being around someone a lot does not necessarily mean there's depth. Our culture, in my opinion, drives us towards superficiality. We talk about the weather and sports and politics and what we're having for dinner, maybe even for hours on end, without ever sharing of ourselves. We are in a viral pandemic, but as a nation, we've been in a loneliness pandemic for much longer. Many people are physically isolated, but many more people who are around others all day are lonely. And right now, when it's harder to be physically with people, of course depth is harder. But let's do what we can. Let's use the tools we have. Let's use phones and WhatsApp and Zoom and so on. All this technology. And I know some of us, because people say this to me, some of us prefer not to use those things. But surely it's better to use technology than not have connection with people. If we've, you know, if we've got the access to technology, surely that's better than not connecting with people. One of my favourite things to do in recent months is to meet up with people and go for a walk. We're still allowed to meet each other outdoors at the moment, unless the rules change. So I've been meeting people by the sea. Go for a walk, get fresh air, get some exercise, and I've had loads of really great, deep conversations with people across the church. Not everybody, it's a lot of people at our church, but plenty of people. What a blessing that we can do this where we live. But I think sometimes because we're British, well, at least most of us are, we get into this reserved way of thinking. We think nobody wants to be bothered with hearing from us. We keep to ourselves. I think we've been trained by our culture to think that people don't want deep relationships. But they do. They do. People might be apprehensive at first, but when we pursue depth by asking questions, being interested, listening, sharing of our own lives, 99% of the time people love it. Which should not be surprising, because meaningful relationships are what we were made for. So whether it's on a walk or on a phone or in a partnership group context, ask yourself, we're spending time together, but is there depth? Is there depth? Third thing, they actively encouraged. Another unspectacular one. It's bubbling under the surface of the passage until it's clear at the end, the summary, and Paul says that they were encouraging, comforting, and urging you to live lives worthy of God, who calls you into his kingdom and glory. You also see it back at the start of 1 Thessalonians. Paul just unleashes this wave of positive, affirming love of these people. A huge part of doing life together as a church is encouraging one another. But let's have this right, because encouragement is not the sort of bland, mushy niceness we sometimes end up thinking it is. Encouragement, defined right here, is urging people to live lives worthy of God. Encouragement is not just making people feel better about themselves, although that may have a place. Encouragement is helping move people in a certain direction, towards God. So it's encouraging, you know, for example, if somebody comes and says, great talk today, appreciated it. That's nice, that's encouraging, I like that. But it would also be encouraging if someone came to me and said, come on, Matt, you need to remember what God has done and see things a bit differently. Or even saying, I think you can do better than this. Those are encouragement too, if the aim is to help me live a life worthy of God. At the moment, encouragement is, again, a bit more tricky when we don't see people, but it's probably more important than ever. When we normally meet on a Sunday, for many of us, this is a time of encouragement. We have that feeling of momentum. We catch up with people. We pray for people. There's loads of benefits to it. Without that, we need to find encouragement in different ways of spurring one another on towards God. But one way we can help each other is that when we do pick up the phone, when we do see or speak to people, look for ways to deliberately be encouraging. As a friend, what does this other person need to hear? What piece of truth or words of affection? What few sentences will brighten up their day and help them move towards God? It ties into the depth thing again. Encouragement is far more meaningful and has far more impact when you and the other person actually know each other pretty well. Fourth thing, they saw people as family. Paul uses family relationships to describe his relationships with the Thessalonians several times. He calls them brothers and sisters, and at different points he characterises himself and Silas as like young children or mothers or fathers. It was absolutely central to the great stuff that happened in Thessalonica that they were essentially a family to each other. We often talk about being a church family, which is great, but the challenge here is how to make sure we actually live as though that's true. When people are your family, they are your family 24/7, not for a couple of hours in a midweek Bible study. That's the model I think we see in Thessalonica. We are God's family to one another all the time. And what I like about this passage is how Paul and Silas, in a sense, took different family roles at different times. So at one point, Paul remembers nurturing them like a mother. In other words, they were giving out care to other people. But at another point, he says, we were like little children among you. In that context, meaning we weren't authoritarian. We didn't assume a position as if we were above you. I love this because church is a family, but it's a family of equals. People may have leadership roles, but you know, those come and go. It's not meant to be that some do all the work and others do all the receiving, but that everyone is involved, and at different points, everyone benefits everyone else in different ways. Right now, we can't meet on a Sunday, but we are no less family to each other. Sadly, I only saw my mum and dad once in 2020, but they aren't any less my mum and dad. In the same way, we are just as much family to each other. If you see people as family, you treat them a bit differently. Even if they behave a bit badly or they rub you up the wrong way, they're family. So you stick with them, or maybe you're stuck with them, but they remain your family. Because Paul saw the Thessalonians as family, he invested thoroughly in them. He cared about them spiritually, practically, everything, all of life. When I graduated from university, a long time ago now, I lived in Newcastle, up in the frozen northeast, and I worked for a Christian charity that worked with students. And there was a bunch of us in our team who were in our early 20s, and the team was led by a slightly older couple called Chip and Diane. He's American, as you can probably guess from the name Chip. And they were brilliant, but the best thing that they did was treat our team as family. And we'd be at their house loads. Diane would make huge, very nice meals for everybody. We used to play games with their kids. It was like being part of their family, and it was never formal. Sometimes you'd have a cup of tea in the kitchen while they were doing the ironing, or Chip would say, can you come and help me move some stuff in the garden? You'd help the kids with the homework. And there'd be chat about what was going on in life throughout. It was brilliant. Everybody benefited from it. And it was better than going over for a sort of nice dinner party. It was doing life together. And since then, especially since being married, Naomi and I have always tried to live like that, and we've tried to have people in our home and treat people like their extended family, not just social friends. I think this is the modern version of what happened in Thessalonica. That's what I would love to see happen across our church. Not so easy, again, right now. But if you take on the perspective that others at church are your family, see them how God leads you to do genuinely do life with them, even in a pandemic. There are ways. There are things we can do for each other, ways of connecting. But why not ask God to give you the perspective that our church is your family and see what ideas he brings to you in terms of better connecting with one another at this time. And if you haven't have any great ideas, I'd love to hear about them. So that was the four things. Paul and Silas started a church community that became known internationally by spending 1 month doing life with people with integrity, depth, encouragement, and seeing people as their family. Really down-to-earth stuff. We live in different times. Our culture works differently, and right now there are some very unusual circumstances. But if we imagine if we grow and grow in living this out as a church, that we would see what it really means to do life together. Now, you might think about the things on that list and in that passage and think, well, that's all good stuff. I can see why we should do it. But how much does this actually impact the people around me? Remember again, the Thessalonian church was totally shaped by the brief investment of a couple of people following God's ways and armed only with the good news about Jesus. It's transformative. Sure, we are a bit inhibited right in what we can do right now. We are inhibited, but it won't be that way forever. And I'm sure that the journey God has us on, that he's moving us forwards in, very much rests on us doing life together. We might have to be creative, but there's no reason we can't figure out how to get on with doing it if we actually want it. Let me pray. Father God, thank you for the great examples we see in this passage. We want to do life together because you set the pattern. Jesus came and did life with us when he didn't need to, he just wanted to. Help us as a church to follow after him, even when it's inconvenient, uncomfortable, and costly, because he's worth following. Help us be creative in these strange and uncertain times, and thank you that your ways stand in every circumstance we might ever find ourselves in. Let us be a church that in the years ahead is known for humbly investing love in one another and in our community. Amen.